From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Debbie Evans is back with me today. Debbie is a retired NHS nurse, a former advisor to the UK's Department of Health, and she is currently nursing correspondent for UK Column News. Debbie, how are you?
Oh, Jesse, lovely to be back with you. How am I? Do you know what? I actually don't know. I'm not even sure what day of the week it is, what year it is, what planet I'm on. It just seems to be crazy busy. And I'm meeting myself coming back. And I think it's because, tragically, and it is tragically, but more and more people, as they're becoming aware of what's going on, or they've lost somebody close to them, or they know somebody that's sick at the moment, more people are coming to tell their stories, and each story is just as harrowing and tragic as the next one. And so the volume of work is immense because, as I say, more and more people are becoming aware. And I don't know what it's like where you are, but in the UK, you know, as I look around the world and I think to myself, you know, is it just the UK that is in absolute disunite, absolute carnage? Because I don't know how much more disunited we can be, actually, in the UK. And I hear that, you know, things have quietened down a little bit, maybe in some countries, but certainly not here. I mean, we've got a government that's all but collapsed. We've got huge amounts of money being sent to Ukraine, whilst we've got a health service that's in total and utter collapse. The COVID agenda is finishing one minute, starting again the next. No one knows quite what's happening, but it's still hanging around like a bad smell. So it's tough times, and it doesn't look to be getting any easier. I mean, how does that compare with what you're hearing?
Well, here in the US, there is disarray, to be sure, but it's not taking the same shape, I would say, as it is in the UK. It seems more diffuse to me, and I think that has to do with the size of the US compared to the UK. There's, I would say, the same crises happening in the US as there are in the UK. For example, the migrant crisis in the UK, there's a huge migrant crisis at the southern border of the US, as Mark Anderson frequently reports on at UK Column. But where I am in New Jersey, which is quite far from the southern border, you wouldn't know there's a problem, even if you bring it up to your neighbor. It's very likely they're unaware or only peripherally aware that there's a huge problem going on down there, and that it's leading to things like Governor Greg Abbott of Texas putting migrants on buses and sending them to so-called sanctuary cities, which I find to be a reprehensible act. We're talking about human beings here. These aren't chess pieces to be shuttled around in some sort of political game. These are people's lives. And yes, there should be vetting. It shouldn't be a free-for-all, but it seems like in that case, Governor Abbott, and he's not alone, these puppet politicians aren't taking the crisis seriously. And are looking at it as a way to score political points. But getting back to my main point, I would say the crises here are the same, but the impact is not as acutely felt because of the size of the U.S. Things have a more spread out feeling to them, but what's happening in the UK is certainly happening here. And to that, I would add globally, it's a global crisis of crises, and it's a crisis of crises that's been driven into existence, as we've talked about many times.
Yeah, I think I'd completely agree with you. And it does feel very intense in the UK because obviously, you know, we're an island nation. We've got a diverse, dense population. And from what I can see here anyway, and I know it's going on all around the world, but it seems to like every single day there's a different strike, or there's a different emergency, or there's a different something else to be worried about. And when I looked at the World Economic Forum's global 2023 agenda, I noticed this word polycrisis, and I was going to mention it more on the column yesterday, and I mentioned it briefly, but this word polycrisis is going to be the new buzzword for 2023. And what it means basically is they're going to throw absolutely everything at you all at once. So any catastrophe, whether it be climate, cost of living, whether it be a cyber attack, whether it be war or another pandemic, it's going to be a polycrisis. So that's what we're heading for. And you know, I can already see this cascade of information, because that's what confuses everybody, is this cascade of information. And it's interesting because somebody sent me an email only yesterday and said, oh, have you seen the NHS website? It's now headed, this is the title, NHS issues final call to come forward for COVID booster. And it says now that the NHS is encouraging people to come forward for their COVID booster before the offer, part of the biggest and most successful program in health history, ends next month. So on one hand, the NHS is saying, you better come for your booster now because we're ending the deal. And then I saw the very same day on the news, an article from, I think it was Sky News, saying that spring and autumn boosters are planned. So, you know, they're stopping them in a month, but they're getting ready to roll out the next phase of injections, whatever that be, whether it be, you know, an all-in-one shot with COVID and flu, etc., for vulnerable people. That's what they're planning. So we're going to end up with all of these different things going on in the world and cascades of information in order to confuse us and in order to fear us. And, you know, going on from what we were talking about last week with the PCR test and, you know, how a dodgy test, because let's face it, that's what it is. It's a dangerous, dodgy test that doesn't work and nobody should take it. And I thought then, actually, everything starts with apps and Fitbits and watches and these devices, because I've worked out that what Dr. James Giordano was saying in his Mad Traddock lecture was that we were looking for morbidity, not mortality. That's what they were looking for. And of course, this is what they're up to. They don't want to kill you per se straight away, or it doesn't seem to they want to do that. What they want to do is make everybody sick. And this goes back to your point, Jesse, that because I thought about what you said last week in that, you know, you weren't kind of on the depopulation agenda. And I get that because it's accelerated. But then I thought, no, this is a really big money-making machine, isn't it? Because pharmaceutical companies, biotech companies, all of these life sciences, genomics, they don't make money from healthy people. They only make money from sick people. So if you make people sick in the first place, they're going to come rushing back to the health service looking for something to help them feel better or something to cure them. And if they're not sick, then, hey, let's make you think you're sick. So let's make you reliant on your Fitbit and your Apple Watch or your iPhone or your app on your Android phone, whatever it may be. Let's make you think you're sick, because we know you can't get hold of a doctor, because it's been very difficult to get anywhere near a doctor. And especially in the UK, we've got, like, I think it's 8+ million now on the NHS waiting list. So what help can we give you? You need to look after yourself, but we'll help you. We'll give you an app. And if our app thinks that your body's underperforming, then we'll make you worried and we'll make you try to seek other health advice and maybe more pharmaceuticals. So the whole agenda is actually about making a lot of money, but also making a lot of people sick. And by relying on these apps to tell you if if your blood pressure's too high or if your blood sugar. I mean, how can we trust any of these apps? Who makes these apps? Who makes these devices that the MHRA and everyone else appear to regulate? Who makes them? Because my guess is that the information coming from them is not accurate, and it's there to create stress, to create worry and anxiety in people thinking they're sick when they're not. Because we seem to be, I mean, I might just be being a bit unfair, but in my day when I was being brought up, you know, you looked in the mirror, and if you were walking and talking and breathing and eating and drinking, then you probably were okay. And if you didn't have any symptoms of anything, you wouldn't go and see a doctor. But now we're living in the times of, well, no, you haven't got any symptoms, but we're going to test you anyway. Well, let's test you early because we might pick up something. Well, why? Why are healthy people being sucked in to going getting tested for something when they've got no symptoms, they feel absolutely fine, and the chances are that they'll get a result back that might not be accurate? And this really worries me. It worries me that people have become so dependent on doctors, on allopathic medicine, on apps, and on these devices, that it's causing so much anxiety. I just wish everybody would look in a mirror and go, you know what, I'm okay. And if I'm okay, then I can carry on with my day. I don't need to seek any medical help or any medical advice. Because it's really easy, isn't it, to listen to Google. How many of you listening, and I'm included, I've done it as well, have thought, oh, I've got this or that, and you punched in the symptoms to Google and you've come up with all sorts of terrible things and thought, oh no, oh my goodness, you know, panic. But this is all designed to make us frightened and to make us anxious. So I think my big message to everybody this week is, get rid of your apps, throw away your watches, the ones that give you health apps and well-being apps and all the rest of it. Look in the mirror and look to your family and to your friends and to the people that love you and care for you and know who you are and know how you normally are, and consult them before you consult any of these ridiculous apps. So I think that's my big message for this week, Jesse. Sorry, that was a bit of a ramble, wasn't it?
No, that was spot on. I fully agree with that. We need to get back to trusting ourselves, trusting how we feel, trusting how we interpret what we see and what we hear. Because a big part of the last 3 years has been an operation to decouple us from trusting ourselves, how we feel, our perceptions, our understanding of reality. And that part of the COVID-19 operation is continuing and it's accelerating. And we need to recognize when that's being forced on us when that part of the operation is being forced on us, and take a step back and think and evaluate for ourselves what's happening, whether it's with regard to our health or somebody else's health or what we're being told is happening in the community at large, what we're being told by apps we may be using. And I agree with you, we shouldn't use any of those. I don't use any of those. I don't trust them in any way to give me accurate data or to protect that data. So we need to get back to the basics of thinking for ourselves, evaluating for ourselves, coming to our own conclusions, and using that information to drive ourselves forward and not let ourselves be driven by this very powerful operation that's 3 years in the running now. And it's very difficult to do because so many of us have been psychologically terrorized over the last 3 years. And again, that's continuing and it's accelerating. But once we realize that that is an operation that's being carried out on us, in addition to the injection operation, we can not only see what's happening for what it is, but realize that this is not organic. This is not an act of God. This is something that is being forced upon us as an attack. And there are ways, simple ways, although hard to get back to, but simple ways nonetheless, that we can sidestep this attack, at least in large part. And we need to get back to doing that. And one of those ways is realizing the pseudoscience of virology and the fear that that pseudoscience has been weaponized to cause in the global population, and how that fear brings about sickness, how that fear brings about death. And just to add to the crises that are global, but are the same in the UK as in the US, excess mortality is a huge one. Excess mortality in both countries is through the roof, and that's putting it mildly. And I think that there is a depopulation agenda, but it's not the whole agenda. No. I think that the powers that ought not be are fine with and even want some people to be killed off. But you're right, not everybody, because there's an industry at stake here. There are many other things at stake here that require a certain amount of people to be alive and to be controlled and to be forced into positions of enslavement for various reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're never going to wipe out that. I mean, when I looked at Diagles, it seemed to be that there was a depopulation agenda in the West, but not in China, not in Russia. The depopulation agenda was targeted. And, you know, we can clearly see the demise of the West. But what worries me, you know, is that when people, we've all been hearing and reading about civil uprisings in many different countries for many different reasons over centuries. But if you make a whole global population sick, or you make them think they're sick, then automatically you're putting them in a weak position so that they are unable to defend themselves, so they are unable to uprise. And therefore, the only population that's left are the ones that the strongest that are left, but they are in the minority. So, you know, the whole plan all along was, well, how do we keep everybody quiet? How do we make everybody sick? How do we get money from people through big pharma and biotech, etc.? And making people sick has also disabled them from protests, from civil uprising, from, I mean, you know, we represent many of the unvaccinated represent the vaccine injured many times because they're too sick to speak or they're too sick to stand up for themselves. So someone has to stand up for them. And by making everybody sick or making everybody think they're sick, it's, you know, you can see the way that it would roll out. So it's a really cruel, cruel way. But what I'm seeing over here is almost a targeted campaign to make elderly people extinct, literally extinct. You know, we don't want old people anymore. And while we're at it, we don't want disabled people, because now we can use CRISPR-Cas9 and we can genomically engineer people's DNA so we can remove the bits that we don't like. You know, this is scary, and this is where we go into, again, you know, you always end up on the transhumanism 2 pathway. But the cruel way that they're doing this, in that people are becoming sicker and sicker, and as I'm seeing the excess mortality going up and up and up, I'm also seeing much more blame being attached to COVID, much more blame being attached to lockdown, much more blame being attached to the whole agenda, but never to the injections, never to the injections. But we have to look at the injections and the increased mortality. And also that we might never know what the true figure is, because so many now of the vaccine injured who are now discovering they're injured still aren't attributing it to the original or maybe the second shot or however many they've had. They don't attribute it because it was so long ago. So my guess is that even, you know, centuries down the line, when people come to read back about what went on in the COVID era, because that's what it seems to have become, nobody's ever going to know the true facts because it's all being covered up. And that's scary. That is really scary, because the extent of this democide is never going to be fully understood, I don't think, only from people like us who are talking about it now.
Right. And we can only estimate what the toll has been so far and what the toll will be. And I think of elderly people in my family and extended family who've died recently. Some died from a massive stroke, some died from cardiovascular issues. And I ask others in my family, do you know if they received any of the injections for so-called COVID-19? And the response I get, if anybody even wants to go down that path, is, well, yeah, but they were old and they were sick for a while, so that's it. It was their time to go, and that's what happened. Maybe, but when I look at the temporal closeness of their deaths and how quickly their conditions deteriorated, I have to ask that question based on what I know, and I suspect that many of them, if not all of them, had their lives cut short, sick as they were, by these injections. And they likely went for multiple rounds. So not just the so-called primary series, but for the so-called boosters as well. But I'll never know for sure. And I extrapolate that out to an untold number of people in the world. And it's mind-bending to think about. We'll never know that true number. And the number is accumulating every day. The excess mortality statistics only give us a glimpse, I would argue, at what's going on. And that glimpse is horrifying enough. The VAERS data, the yellow card scheme data, they only give us glimpses of what's going on. And those glimpses, again, are horrific. So
yeah,
just imagine if we were able to truly account for the full scope of the democide, the full scale of the democide. But
wow.
I agree with you. We'll only ever be able to estimate, but it's unfathomable in a lot of ways, even though it's happening as we speak, and sometimes happening right before our eyes when we see people drop on the sports pitch or drop while presenting a news broadcast, either live or shortly afterward. It's all happening right in front of our eyes. And again, going back to the psychological operation of part of COVID-19, in inverted commas, we've been conditioned to not believe and not trust what our own eyes are seeing, to find other ways to explain what's happening aside from the most obvious, most likely explanation for what is happening.
No, and I think that's the scariest thing, is we're never ever going to know. And how weird would it be, Jesse, if we're having this conversation now and imagine somebody discovering a dusty, I don't know, it's not a dusty tape anymore because everything's digital, but somebody listens back to this and thinks, oh, wow, they said then they're never going to know the extent of this because it was so big, and they actually don't ever know. And what I've seen evolve, and I watched a very interesting lecture. It was a TED lecture on dying, and it kind of triggered me a bit, because I thought, you know, dying is a very natural process. And let's face it, all of us think about death at some point during our lives, you know, whether or not if it's to make a will or pass something down or choose your funeral hymn or whatever, you know, we all think of death at some time. But since this whole pandemic, people have become death phobic and almost obsessed with dying and frightened of dying. And whereas in my day when I was nursing, we had social deaths, and I know that sounds a really weird term, but it was where we knew somebody was elderly, we knew somebody was vulnerable, and the family cared for them, and we were always around them, and we were there at the very end, and we held their hands at the end, and it was a natural death. Now, what we're looking at, in my opinion, is a medical death, and that's very different from a social death. So what we have are medically induced deaths, whether it be through the injections or whether it be through an end-of-life care plan that the patient should never have been on in the first place, or whether it be on a dodgy Ronapreve or a dodgy Remdesivir or Paxlovid, because we have to remember that, you know, these medications are out there and they're biological medications, as Hedley Reese will tell you, they're dangerous. So whichever bullet you happen to have escaped, at the end of the day, what we're looking is we're heading into an era of medical deaths. which is is terrifying, because that eliminates the natural process of dying. And we need to embrace that again. You know, people have got too scared of dying. And that's, you know, in my opinion, that's a lie anyway, because I always, my own personal belief is that, you know, we're like astronauts, only we're doing an earth walk and we've got our suits on, and our suits are our bodies, but inside our souls are eternal and they never die. So it's only our suits that get, you know, a bit tired and they get worn out, and we have to give up our suits. So to actually make these deaths into a medical death, which is scary, you know. And I was speaking to a nurse only yesterday who needed surgery. She's an NHS trained nurse. She went abroad for her surgery. She didn't trust her own country, her own NHS, to perform the surgery on her because she thought that they would kill her. And medical deaths now, perhaps we should be using the term more and not just saying death or excess mortality. We should be saying excess medical mortality, excess medical deaths, because certainly from where I'm sitting, that would appear to be what we're witnessing.
Yes, some have used the term iatrogenicide. So iatrogenic means injury caused by medicine, broadly speaking. So iatrogenicide is a syllogism taken from iatrogenic to describe what you just described, medical death. And I think it's a very appropriate term that should gain more traction, because that's largely what we're talking about now. It's, we read reports about people dying suddenly, but naturally. But that's a contradiction in and of itself. Sure, some people die suddenly and naturally, but at the rate we've been seeing, I don't think so. It's not something I've witnessed in my 40 years on this earth, and I know I'm not alone in saying that. There are millions upon millions, if not billions, of others who feel and think, know the same, that something is very, very wrong. And a lot of the deaths we're seeing, we're hearing about, are not natural. They're being caused by, I would say, so-called medicine, allopathic medicine. I have increasingly come to view allopathic medicine as not medicine in a traditional sense. It's a bastardization of medicine, of healing. It's something that was brought into existence largely by the Rockefellers, and it's led us to where we are today. And if the path we followed led us to where we are today, then of what use has the path been? And I'm borrowing that line from one of my favorite novels called No Country for Old Men by Cormac McCarthy, also an excellent film. But I think that question is spot on and ever relevant. If the path you took led you to where you are today, of what use was the path? Why are we still following this path of allopathic medicine when it's been one of the main drivers to bring us to where we are here and now, today, in this very moment, talking about what we're talking about?
It's ironic, isn't it? Because when you think back and you think how they were, killing homeopaths, killing naturopaths, you know, they were all seen as magicians and bad people. And now, I think, given that time again, it's the big pharma and it's the Albert Boulas and the Pascal Soirots, and it's them that need to be in that same position. We need, I mean, I said something and it kind of fell out of my mouth, but and I wondered if I should have said it, but now I'm thinking, yes, I should have. And what I said on the UK column yesterday was, I think we ought to actually forget allopathic medicines, full stop. Just let's not even jumble things up by saying some of it's okay, some of it's not okay. Let's just avoid it, full stop. And Hedley Reese, who I was talking to, said, oh, no, you can't do that because people, what about people that are on insulin? What about people that need a general anesthetic? What about people that need painkillers? And I thought about that and took it back to how I would feel if I was diabetic. And many cases of diabetes 2, which is what we generally see in the population, can be reversed just through diet, exercise, and changing your lifestyle. I've done it with my own stepfather. He is diabetic, and he was on tablets. He was first of all diet controlled, then tablets, and then was going to go on to insulin. And we managed to reverse him completely by just, you know, changing his lifestyle. So I thought, okay, so that can be solved pretty well. Anesthetic. Would I have an anesthetic now? No, I actually wouldn't. I mean, I'm in a position in the NHS in the UK where I would not trust an anesthetic because I'd be worried what they were going to do to me under the anesthetic. So I would rather not go anywhere near the NHS and rely totally on natural medicine. And then I thought about painkillers, and I thought, no, I would still rather be in pain than take an allopathic medicine. So I've gone from one extreme, if you like, to completely another, because as a trained nurse, trained in the NHS, obviously we deliver allopathic medicine to people. We rely on it. That's what our drug trolleys are full of. You know, very, very few drug trolleys are carrying basic bog standard vitamins and echinacea. We're carrying pharmaceutical products. And I've completely switched now to the fact where I don't want to see a doctor. I don't want to consult a doctor. I don't want any medical surgical procedures. Thank you very much. And I certainly don't want to be tested for anything because, you know, if they test me for something and decide that I've tested positive for something, then that's just something else for me to worry about that actually I don't need to worry about because I feel fine. So Do you know where I'm coming from with that? It just seems like, wow.
Yes.
No, you carry on, Jesse.
I think that we do need to do away with allopathic medicine. And I suspect you'll agree with me that it's not something we can do overnight. It has to be a phased process. And I'm thinking particularly in terms of if you get hit by a car and break a bone or multiple bones, you need to go to a hospital and have possibly surgery or whatever procedure or procedures done to alleviate, to fix the damage as best as possible. And that would fall under the allopathic model, at least largely. And there's a place for that, but where it becomes a problem is the drugs that are used in that treatment. So the painkillers, for example, there are probably a whole host of others that I'm not aware of because I've broken a bone, but I've never gone to the hospital to have it looked at. And it's only been minor. It was in my hand. So I don't know what the experience is like if you break your leg severely or break your arm severely, but I
can help you out on that. I can help you out on that. I did a great job of snapping my foot in half 3 years ago, literally snapping it in half. And I was non-weight bearing in plaster for 9 months and then in an orthopedic boot for another 9 months. I couldn't understand it because I kept saying to the consultant, don't be ridiculous. You know, if somebody fractures their neck or femur, they're normally up and walking in 8 to 10 weeks. Why is it going to be 18 months? But apparently because feet are full of little bones. So I went through a lot of pain. But you know what, Jesse, if that, God forbid, happened again, and I am now very careful, but if that happened again, I still would not want to go to a hospital. My son broke his back and needed 7-level fusion, spinal surgery. But he has a bone condition which doesn't allow him to have the surgery, which actually, looking back on, I'm very grateful for. So we literally had to transfer a hospital bed to my front room, and I had to nurse him at home because it was the only safe place to nurse him. It was not safe for him to stay in hospital. And even with a broken back, we managed, we got there. And I've been discussing it with nurses in the UK because we've got organizations here that are trying to set up hubs and personal health hubs and public health hubs. But what we actually need, you know, is emergency services. What we need is protocols from naturopaths, from emergency medicine practitioners and emergency nurses and paramedics to tell us what we can do with homeopath and naturopathic medicines and with techniques. What can we do without needing the use of allopathic medicine, the use of allopathic anesthetics and, you know, big sort of surgery with a lot of toxic gases. So what we need to set up is an emergency service, because when people get sick quickly, that's when they're vulnerable, because at the moment, the only place they have to go is the health service in whichever country they're in. And from the minute you enter, you literally cross over the threshold of most health services, I think, you're pretty much on your own, because our health service here is running on its own law. I mean, that there is no COVID agenda in the UK. People aren't wearing masks or don't have to wear masks. There is no social distancing. We're not getting data. We're not getting Downing Street briefings every day. And yet the NHS are still making us walk around in one direction, go in one door, out of the other door, wear masks. They've still got their own protocols. And if you do test positive for COVID, you're on your own. So I think when people get it, when it's an emergency, that's where it puts them at highest vulnerability. And that's where we're looking with lawyers to work out if there's any way that we can opt out of care, even if it is an emergency, because that puts us in a vulnerable position. So it's a very complex situation now. And whereas, you know, we were all grateful for the health service and we felt safe in the health service, now all of a sudden it's become a very unsafe place to be, a very scary place to be, but above all, a very lonely place to be, because you really are on your own in there. You don't have family and friends to support you, to watch your back, to see what's going on. You're on your own. And that worries me. So emergency care is what I would like to see set up around different, in every country, in different places, so that when someone is having a heart attack, when somebody is having a stroke, you know, they need that golden hour treatment. They've only that first hour is so important. And at the moment in the UK, you can't get an ambulance for 8 hours, let alone get anywhere near a doctor or a hospital. So that golden hour, if we can offer people that golden hour and time and reassurance and kindness, because, you know, being in a calm environment, being with gentle kind people that you trust is very, very beneficial to your health. It calms the whole situation down. Patients at the moment are going into the NHS. They're being left on trolleys. They're listening to people screaming and crying. It's chaos in there. They're feeling very lonely. So I think for me, it would be to see emergency, you know, emergency hubs springing up where people can go to when they're really vulnerable and they're really scared. So that's where I would like to see it go. And if anybody's got a model or is doing anything like that out there and would like to let us know or let you know, Jesse, then, you know, we would love to look at your model and try and follow it as much as we possibly can if it's working.
Yes, absolutely. And I believe there are people who are working on that, and I can't list them off the top of my head right now, but there's certainly a huge, relatively huge movement underway to get away from allopathic medicine, to get away from the pseudoscience of particularly virology and infectious disease that has driven it from the get-go, and to get back to natural healing remedies, not so-called remedies that merely mask the symptoms or push them further into the body only to have them re-manifest at a later time. And there's something to be said about that with regard to ivermectin, for example. I'm not one of these people who poo-poos ivermectin as horse paste, but if we're going to be honest, we have to look at it as something that alleviates symptoms and is possibly pushing down the mechanisms of sickness into the body so that what will happen is that they'll remanifest at a later time and possibly worse. And we have to look at ivermectin, for example, as part of the allopathic model, as helpful as it may have been. And a lot of people get upset when they hear that, but we need to get to the truth about health and healing if we're going to seriously get away from the system that's brought us to where we are. And
yeah.
Speaking,
and we need not to be scared either, Jesse. You know, we need not to be scared, because that's what they want. You know, they really do. If everybody that's scared, everyone that's fearing, that's absolutely perfect. That's where they want us to be. We have to be happy. We have to walk around with a smile on our face. We have to be the best people that we can possibly be, because that to them is, it's like a silver bullet to a vampire. You know, it's like they don't want us to be happy. They want us to be confused. They want us to be frightened. They want us to be anxious. They want us to be divisive. They want us to lose our friends. They want us to have divisions in our families, you know, to lose members of your family, not just through death, but because people won't speak to you because you're being discriminated against. You know, this is what they want. So we have to rise above that. And everything, they've inverted everything. So everything that they say is good for you is more than likely harmful for you. Everything that they say will happen probably won't happen. And everything they say won't happen probably will. So we just have to invert everything and say, look, you know what? We cannot walk around frightened. We cannot walk around in fear of what we're going to do tomorrow or next week. Or we have to try to be happy. And to be happy is to have faith. And I've always said this, you know, faith is the antidote to fear. It doesn't matter what you believe in, or whether you believe in God or Jesus or whatever religion or faith you believe in, or whatever. To have faith gives you peace. And when you've got peace, you can be happy. But to show happiness to them and to, you know, not to complain, that's when they hate it. And I think by getting on with our lives and trying to help others, that's the best, the being the best people we can be and not being frightened and be prepared, because, you know, being prepared always gives you that reassurance, you know, just when you're on your next shopping trip, you know, pick up an extra couple of bottles of water, pick up a flashlight or a torch, pick up an extra tin of baked beans or whatever it is, just a couple of candles, just have something so that if the lights do go out, if things do go wrong, you're okay. And you haven't got to be frightened, because you don't need to be frightened of what you're prepared for, because then it's not unexpected. So expect everything, prepare for everything, and then you won't be frightened.
Right. I wholeheartedly agree. In about the last 5 minutes we have, I want to talk about something that has been pushed on us for some time to frighten us, and that is long COVID or post COVID-19, post COVID-19 condition is how the World Health Organization describes it. And I sent you this announcement last night. I don't know if you've had a chance to read it, but a Massachusetts-based company, biotech company called Accella, A-X-C-E-L-L-A, announces regulatory path to registration of AXA1125 for long COVID fatigue. And this is an oral concoction that is supposedly in trials that have been underway, providing benefits for those suffering from so-called long COVID, which, if you look at the WHO definition for it, essentially reveals that this is something that's been made up. And I would submit that people suffering from so-called long COVID perhaps are suffering from the effects of the injections. But getting back to this announcement, I want to read the first paragraph real quick. And this announcement was at businesswire.com. On the 23rd, Accella Therapeutics, a clinical stage biotechnology company pioneering novel approaches to treating complex diseases using multi-targeted endogenous metabolic modulator, EMM, compositions, announced a regulatory path to registration of AXA1125 in the treatment of long COVID fatigue. The company reported that it had received regulatory guidance from the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, the UK's regulatory agency, supporting a single trial that could serve as the registration trial for patients with long COVID fatigue, and aligning on key measurements, including primary endpoint and trial design. Accella will be meeting with the MHRA in the near term to discuss the innovative licensing and access pathway, ILAP, application. The company further reported submission of an investigational new drug, IND, application to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, for a phase 2B/3 trial. There's much more information in this press release, but here we have a biotech company being enabled by the MHRA to pump out this concoction for a condition that has been invented. If you go to the WHO's website and look at the definition of long COVID, it is defined as the continuation or development of new symptoms 3 months after the initial SARS-CoV-2 infection, with these symptoms lasting for at least 2 months with no other explanation. Symptoms. While common symptoms of long COVID can include fatigue, shortness of breath, and cognitive dysfunction, over 200 different symptoms have been reported that can have an impact on everyday functioning. So essentially, we're talking about whatever you want it to be here. It's a made-up diagnosis. But
it's
nonetheless,
an excuse. It's an excuse, isn't it?
Right.
That's what it is. Take all the whistles and bows off. It's just an excuse for everything else. And we'll just lump it under one condition called long COVID.
Right. And unfortunately, we are running up to time, but I wanted to bring that to your attention in case you hadn't had a chance to look at it yet. Because
oh, I had, Jesse, because the minute I see those little letters, MHRA, my red flags are up. And of course, when it mentions ILAP, we can talk about ILAP another time because I know we're really tight for time. But just very quickly, you know, the MHRA, in my opinion, and in Hedley Reese's opinion, seems to be owned and run by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as the UK health system is. In fact, I think Bill Gates owns the whole of One World Health. But we'll talk about it next week, Jesse, I'm sure.
Yes,
I look forward to
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Debbie, thank you so much, as always, for joining me today. And I am already looking forward to next week's chat. So please be well until then.
And ditto to all of you. Thank you, Jesse. God bless. Good night.